Welcome to episode 47 of Power of the Purse podcast. My guest today is Elaine Floyd, writer for Horse's Mouth, an online newsletter for financial advisors. What did her accountant father teach her about money? How did she earn some money in a very unusual way post-divorce? Why did the traditional stockbroker training disgust her? Ever hear of Horse's Mouth? As in, straight from a most unusual name for a financial publication. What was the turning point from writing as part of her job to abandoning the job and writing for a living? Did she starve? Why did she give up her business and go back to being an employee? Why did she take on such a huge topic like Social Security and Medicare to write courses on them? What are some of the mistakes human resources people and retirees make when signing up for Medicare? How did Elaine help a woman trade in a $700 a month benefit for $2,000 a month? How does an ex-spouse affect your Social Security benefits if you were married for more than 10 years? Medicare versus COBRA at retirement? No, COBRA is not a snake. Find out why you need to understand the difference between the two. And how steep are the penalties if you fail to sign up for Medicare? And finally, she'll talk on why women should learn to take risks in investing. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money. This is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Number two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years, until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. And it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better, but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to a rich history of successful women who, when faced with some personal challenges, found the ability to step beyond them. We'll examine some of the truths they made up about money from their life experiences and how that shaped the paths they chose. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Elaine Floyd. Elaine is the Director of Retirement and Life Planning for HorsesMouth.com. And it's a publication that I have, subscribed to is the word, for well over 10 years and enjoyed immensely. She's also the author of a few programs that were designed for financial advisors called Savvy Social Security Planning for Boomers and Savvy Medicare Planning for Boomers. Elaine started her career in 1981 as a registered representative for a major wirehouse, and for some people listening, they may not know what that means, but it's a very large financial services firm. And she received her CFP designation in 1986. After 20 years as an independent financial writer of books, articles, and white papers for the financial services industry, she joined Horse's Mouth in 2008. She holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from UCLA and currently resides in Bellingham, Washington. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. I am very happy to be here.
I have so many things I want to talk to you about today and get information, so I hope we can fit it all in. So let's just jump in. One of the things I'm most interested in knowing about is how you decided or why you decided to get started working in the world of personal finances, not something that's pretty standard operating procedure for women.
Right. Well, you know, I was listening to you delineate your truths that you kind of grew up with, and actually, yeah. I was lucky enough to have a father who was an accountant. I always liked math, and so for me, dealing with money was a very natural thing. And what I learned growing up was one of the most important things I learned growing up as the daughter of an accountant was money was something that you keep track of. That was like the most important thing. Over my life, I've had not very much money and some money. So it has varied, you know, over the years. And so anyway, the way I got into it is this. It's kind of interesting. I majored in psychology. I got married right out of college. I had a couple of kids, stayed home with my kids. And then I got divorced after 11 years of marriage. And that came as a complete surprise. I was completely unprepared to start earning a living on my own. I went on a game show and won $15,000, which bought me a little bit of time. And during that time, I explored different careers. My ex-husband had been a stockbroker, and I would have thought that because he was so different from me, he was a real hard-driving sales type, I thought, well, that's something I could never do. But at the same time, a friend of mine had gone through Merrill Lynch training, and she was, you know, a gentle soul in the world of personal finance. And so I thought, well, maybe I can do this. And so I entered the business in 1981, became sort of a traditional stockbroker. In 1987, I became somewhat enchanted with the business model, which was so focused on commissions and, you know, just deriving revenue from clients, that I left the business. Now, starting around 1984, 85, I started producing a newsletter for my clients. And I also was writing a lot of memos in the office, and I was developing my writing skills and getting a lot of positive feedback on my writing. So I thought, well, this is a good thing. I can combine my writing and my knowledge of personal finance into a career as a freelance financial writer. And so I quit the business, started my own business producing newsletters for other financial people, and wrote some books and white papers, as you mentioned. And Horse's Mouth, which was founded in around 1997, became one of my clients. And I started writing articles for Horse's Mouth, and that eventually led to a full-time job with the firm.
Well, let's roll this back, because there's a thousand things I wanted to jump in and say here. First of all, let's talk about the game show.
Okay.
What game show was this? Was this a national game?
It was Password Plus. Password Plus with Alan Ledden, and Sally Struthers was my partner.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. So you won that day, you won the most money that you can win, or was that the prize, $15,000?
It was over about 4 days. I won for 3 days. You know, if you win on a day, then they bring you back the next day. And if you win, they bring you back the next day. And so my run was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 days.
But now, really, I have to ask this question because I've always thought it was unusual. I've watched game shows that are on 5 days a week, and they talk about coming back tomorrow. Is it really tomorrow, or do you tape 4 or 5 of them in a row and you just have to bring clothes to change?
You do. You tape 4 or 5 in a row. That's exactly right. And then they do take a little break, and I think that's what caused me to lose in the end. I kind of lost my momentum there.
But
I think sort of subconsciously I thought, oh, 15 grand, that's a pretty good amount of money. I'll let somebody else take over now.
Well, yeah, at that time it was. That could have made a big difference.
Yeah,
so you got the 15 grand, and then you said you were going to start something. And where did you decide? Well, I guess we didn't have the kind of compliance issues at that time that we do now, not as stringent. So when did you discover that you had this writing talent?
I think it was, to be honest, I was mutual fund coordinator in my office, which meant if any of there were like 30 brokers in the office, if any of them had questions about mutual, I was basically the one who was like the mutual fund expert in my office. And so my role was to, you know, to promote different funds and to disseminate information about them. So I started putting out these memos, and I made them funny. They were very different from the very dry financial writing that most of them were used to seeing. And I had my assistant copy them onto goldenrod paper. And so with those, whenever the gold memos hit the baskets, everybody would grab them and read them. And I just got lots of very positive feedback on my writing. Now, my the writing I do now doesn't have the humor that it did back then, but basically
too bad.
I know.
With the topics that we have to deal with, a little bit of humor might make a big difference.
It's so true. Maybe I'll rethink that.
Yeah, I think you should. I'm only saying that because I had been writing a column once a month for the regional business newspaper that came out monthly, and it was the column on personal finance. And it was I got to that point doing the same thing, where it was pretty much, okay, you could inject some humor, or more likely, I might call it personality, into what you were writing.
Yes.
But after a while, I got so bored with it, I stopped it. I said, 10 years of doing this is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing then we had things called blogs, which we never had before, where you could really say what you wanted to say with a very skeptical or satirical mm-hmm. tone, whatever it was. And mm-hmm. I loved doing that. So to me, it's a way of self-expression. And I certainly hope that you go back to that kind of writing, because it's just so
well,
refreshing.
Well, it is. And I'll just say that I think the main benefit from my writing comes in my ability to explain things in a way that makes them easy to understand.
I will agree with that, because I've read a lot of what you've written, and I would say that's one of the things that really has impressed me, that you can take very difficult topics and just chunk them down into things that you can grasp, and all of a sudden you'll finish it and go, oh, I get it. Like you want to start with the DOL rules or whatever.
You're right. No, I don't touch that.
Now, that's a little inside joke for people who are listening. It wouldn't be worth it to try to explain it either.
Definitely.
Okay, so then you started writing, and at what point did you say to yourself, hey, I think I have enough skill here that I can let go of my job and rely 100% on my writing?
Well, you know, I did something that I probably would not recommend. I was of the camp back in the 1980s that if you were going to do something with intention, you had to jump into it with both feet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. I prepared some marketing letters to go out to CPAs and lawyers and advisors in my community. And the day before those letters went out, I quit my job. Mm-hmm. And I did it with the idea that once these letters hit everybody's mailboxes, they would beat a path to my door wanting me to produce their newsletters for them. And I couldn't be having my job while I was trying to produce all these newsletters. It was definitely magical thinking, and it was probably the wrong thing to do. But
was the silence deafening?
What?
Silence was deafening.
Actually, what happened was I got one client, and I didn't realize how steep the learning curve was going to be. Producing a newsletter for a client is very different from doing it for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And so I had a very steep learning curve, and it took all of my time that first month to actually produce that newsletter. So it's a good thing I didn't have them all beating a path to my door. But, you know, that first year, I ended up grossing $30,000, which it was a drop in income for me for sure, and it wasn't enough to meet my expenses, but it wasn't too terrible as, you know, business startups go. And
that's
the
great.
Next year I made $45,000, and then it went up from there. And so it worked out okay. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. So then when did you just make the decision then to go with horse's mouth?
You know, they had to kind of talk me into it, because I really loved working for Horse's Mouth, but I also liked having a variety of clients because you never know, you know, having having one client is like, you know, having a job is like having one client. And so it was in discussions with Sean Bailey at Horse's Mouth over a period of several months that I kind of got excited about what I could accomplish by you know, being a full-time employee at Horse's Mouth. And once I joined the firm, you know, I never looked back, and I really am enjoying being an employee, partly because now I don't have to, you know, pound the pavement for, you know, freelance gigs all the time. I don't have to worry about invoicing. I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. I can really focus on the work itself.
Well, tell me, how did you evolve into an expert on two of those? We talked about heavy topics, Social Security and Medicare. How is it that you developed the expertise, the desire to even go there? What prompted you to do that?
When I was freelance writing, I wrote about Social Security. So I started, I wrote several books. I ghost wrote several books on retirement planning, and that's when I kind of started my study of Social Security. You know, at that time, even though I had been trained as a financial advisor, none of us knew very much about Social Security at that time. We didn't get involved in it. We didn't advise our clients on it. We just said, when you turn 65, go down and apply for Social Security. That was all there was to it. Mm-hmm. Well, when I started writing the books and writing the articles for Horse's Mouth on Social Security, that's when I learned that there was so much more to it than anybody realized. And so that was one of the things that got me to join Horse's Mouth, was this idea that I could really get to work developing this program that would teach financial advisors all of the nuances of Social Security that I knew they needed to know but didn't know. And I also knew, because I am a leading-edge baby boomer myself, I was born in 1946, and so in 2008 when I joined the firm was the year I turned 62, so it's like, okay, I want to learn this for myself. And so so that's kind of how it evolved. Number one, my own, you know, my own interest in it, and then number two, just the recognition that this knowledge was so needed out there in the advisory marketplace.
And it would seem that that would be almost enough to take on just Social Security, but then you also added another huge wide open gap in learning when you started with trying to have us understand Medicare.
Right.
Why?
Right. Well, you know, again, I was approaching age 65. I needed to know about Medicare. And and I knew that financial advisors didn't know about Medicare, and I knew that their clients were not being advised, properly advised. And actually, advisors who had bought our Social Security program approached us and said, when are you going to come up with a savvy Medicare planning program? Because my clients are asking about it. And so that's what drove it. And I will tell you, since we've had this program out there over the last 5 years, it has become more and more apparent that people who are retiring from their jobs are not getting good advice on how to transition from employer insurance to Medicare. The reason is that all the people, all the HR people, all the insurance people who sell those group plans, they know the group plan market. They don't understand Medicare, and they don't know how to advise people on as to how to get over to that Medicare system. And there are definite rules, and there are penalties associated with it if you don't sign up on time. Some people are paying too much for their insurance. So it's full of landmines. And, you know, we're just seeing these stories every single day of people who are getting wrong advice from their HR departments, and they're confused, and they don't know what to do. So
all valid points. And so once someone completes these programs and learns what you're trying to teach them, is there any certification that comes out of that?
You know, we have considered that issue over the years, offering a certification. We do offer CE credits, continuing education credits, for certified financial advisors, so there is that. We don't offer a specific credential, partly because I don't know. I just kind of have a personal objection to credentials that are intended to maybe sway clients into thinking that advisors know more than they do. I don't know. I don't want to get too
I hear you.
But
no, I get what you're saying, because I know that a lot of my peers, our peers, use these initials after their name for credibility that is really, there's no way you can use that to equate that with ethics.
That's right.
So somebody may have a lot of knowledge. It doesn't mean that they're going to use it to the client's advantage, but many times it's used for their own advantage just to try to get somebody through the door.
Yep.
So I agree with you. But I still think that the program is really good. And I think that it's some aspect of training and learning that the CFP program, which we're both CFPs, but and we probably did it a long time ago. But I don't know that they really get that involved in either of these two topics in the CFP program.
Right.
So it really is a big gap in learning that we really need to address, because people assume that we understand all this stuff.
And you know, for so many years, advisors have just said, oh, that's not my job. You know, it's just not my job. It's too complicated. But what we are finding is that as the baby boomers are retiring, this is a whole different generation from the generation that advisors are used to working with. You know, the older generation, they would go to the advisor and say, tell me what to do and I'll do it. Baby boomers are approaching it entirely differently. They've been managing their 401k plans on their own for all these many years. Many of them have never even talked to an advisor until they approach retirement, and then they realize how complicated everything is. And very often they start the whole process with Social Security and then Medicare. And so very often they are looking for an advisor who understands these subjects, and then they may or may not give them their retirement money to invest, but they want to get their questions answered first. And so that's really why we created these programs, was that, you know, this is where baby boomers start. They want to know about Social Security and Medicare first, and then they will talk about their investments after that.
Well, I think that I went to my personal financial advisor, meaning I looked in the mirror and said, okay, Lynn, you are approaching, this was last year, you're approaching 65. You've got to make a decision about Social Security. You've got to make a decision about Medicare. And, I mean, when I turned 62, it didn't even occur to me that I need to even be thinking about Social Security, because I had no intention of taking it at that point.
Right.
So I'll tell you, it is a tremendous learning experience to go through it yourself.
It is.
And it is. Nobody can replicate that one. So
that's right.
When you're talking to people who are advisors and about these two topics, you might want to think about the fact that, hey, maybe somebody who's been through it can even give me more information. And I can honestly say it was high drama. You know, I just could not believe all of what was there. I just couldn't believe the choices and what I had to do.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I think what you're doing is really very well intentioned, and it is needed.
Thank you.
So I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
Let's talk about some of the ways that you know that you've seen some results of your knowledge and how it directly applies to people's lives. What differences you've made in people's lives? You mentioned about an elderly widow who went from $700 a month to $2,000 because you told her about some benefits she didn't know she had.
Yep.
Tell me more about that.
That was one example there. And I'll just tell you, this work for me is so gratifying. Even though I'm not working directly with the clients, I'm working with the financial advisors, and each financial advisor has, you know, dozens or hundreds of clients. So I feel like what I'm putting out there is really radiating out into the world, and it really is changing people's lives. The number one thing that we talk about is the lifetime value of Social Security benefits. So many people claim benefits early because they figure, oh, it won't make a difference. Might as well claim at 62. It's only a few hundred dollars less than I'd get if I claimed at 66 or at 70, so I might as well go ahead and get started. Well, one of the first things we did when we developed this program was develop a set of calculators that actually run it out over your life expectancy. And you can set any life expectancy you want, but you can see over your lifetime what the difference will be if you claim at 62 versus 66 or 70. So that's number one, is just really understanding the lifetime value of that income stream. And then as far as the individual clients are concerned, the story that you're mentioning is that this was an advisor who called and just said, I mean, this just made our day. She had an elderly woman in her office. The woman was getting about $700 a month in Social Security. The advisor knew that she was divorced and knew about divorced spouse benefits. And she said to the woman, did you know that you could apply for divorced spouse benefits because you had been married more than 10 years? So they got on the phone to Social Security. It turns out, yes, she could get the benefit, and it raised her benefit to something like $1,100 a month from the $700. And then the advisor said, and you know what? If your ex-husband dies, that amount will double because you will be eligible for a divorced spouse survivor benefit. And wouldn't you know, just a few months later, he did die, and it doubled her amount.
Wow.
Yeah. Now,
that's
people
amazing.
Find a little humor in this and say, well, in mysterious circumstances, huh? But, you know.
No, I didn't even go there. I
mean, good.
but it is true.
And this is something that, you know, women need to know about. Anyone who has, and in this case, this was a marriage that was way early in the woman's life. And
yeah.
So she never would have even thought about it. And mm-hmm. So that's, you know, a very important thing for women to understand is that if you have been married more than 10 years, you can collect a benefit based on your ex-husband's work record. And mm-hmm. Depending on your age, you may be able to take that benefit while letting your own benefit grow. Now, they changed that rule, and you had to have turned 62 by the end of 2015 in order to take advantage of that. But still, there are probably some women listening here now who may have stayed home with their kids. They may have a rather low Social Security benefit, and they can claim a spousal benefit based on their current husband if they're still married, or on an ex-husband. If they're divorced and were married over 10 years.
And just to make the playing field equal, we have to also say that that applies to ex-wives as well.
Yes.
Husbands
yes.
can claim under ex-wives.
Yes,
so if
absolutely.
You had, if you
gender
were
neutral.
Fortunate enough to have married a very wealthy or highly productive woman and then divorced, you might be able to get
yeah.
something from her.
Well, I'll tell you something to sort of preserve the gender stereotype, if you will, but we've had, you know, high-earning men whose wives have died, and so they are widowers. What they can do is receive a survivor benefit based on their deceased wife's record while they let their own benefit grow to age 70. They can mm-hmm. start that survivor benefit as early as age 60. So
yeah.
we encounter, you know, a number of high-earning people whose spouses have died, and they can take advantage of that survivor benefit.
What other wonderful stories can you think of?
Oh, gosh.
How about on the Medicare side? Is there somewhere where you can think of some event where you helped somebody with, you mentioned before about people paying really high premiums for benefits they're never going to use or for programs that are just way too rich for what they need?
One example in the Medicare realm is somebody who retires and they have good, you know, pretty good health insurance at work. They retire. The HR representative tells them to go on to COBRA. A COBRA is a way for people to continue their employer health insurance for another 18 months or so after they leave employment. They have to pay for it themselves, but they can still continue on that plan. The problem is that once they leave employment, they have 8 months to sign up for Medicare. And if they don't sign up for Medicare during that eight-month period, they will be subject to late enrollment penalties when they finally do sign up. But even worse, when they come off the COBRA after 18 months, they can't just sign up for Medicare at that time. They have to wait until Medicare's general enrollment period, which is from January to March of each year, with coverage starting the following July. So what basically happens is they end up with no coverage for some period of time until the Medicare starts. And this is HR directors are doing this because they COBRA is what they understand. They're used to retiring employees to COBRA, and they don't understand that they're actually doing them a disservice because it messes up the Medicare part of it.
I wonder what kind of corporate liability exposure people have in situations like that where it's just an automatic thought. You just go into COBRA
it's a good question. You know? Now, we have pretty much blanket advice for anyone who turns 65, call Social Security. Explain your health insurance situation. Certain people, if you keep working after age 65 and you have a good plan and your plan covers 20 or more employees, you don't have to sign up for Medicare right away. You can defer it. But mistakes get made. And if you get wrong advice from anybody other than a representative of the Social Security Department Administration, you have no recourse. So that's why we advise everybody, even if you think it's clear what you should be doing at 65, call Social Security and make a record of that conversation. Because if you go back at, say, 68 and say, oh, but, you know, my insurance agent or my HR person told me I didn't have to sign up for Medicare yet, and Medicare says, yes, you did, and we're going to slap you with 3 years of penalties.
Wow.
You have no recourse.
And what are those penalties like?
It's 10% of the Part B premium. So the Part B premium this year is $134 a month. So it would be 10% added to that. But it's for every year that you went without Medicare, and it continues for the rest of your life. So it's an easy charge to avoid if you do the right thing and know what you're doing.
Wow. there's incentive enough to say, oh, I think I better check this out.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. That very helpful. A lot of very good stuff.
Good.
Let me switch this around at this point because I'm interested in something that I think is very valid to get into this conversation, and that is when you were younger. You mentioned about the fact that your father was an accountant and taught you to be accountable for everything that you spent.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, what was your first memory around money?
I would say the first memory was that we didn't have enough of it. I remember not being able to get a new coat because there wasn't enough money. I remember having to go another year without new shoes because there wasn't enough money. My father had worked as a bookkeeper for a small business in town, and then he kind of did what I did, you know, many years prior. He went out on his own and formed his own business as an accountant and with clients. Well, you know, there were some very, very, very lean years in there. And so that's pretty much what I remember about money. But then I will say, as I got into high school, he was doing better. I was getting what I guess turned out to be a generous allowance because I ran into a friend at a recent reunion, and she said the thing that she remembered about me in high school was that I had such a big allowance. So whatever that means.
Was it the difference between a quarter and 50 cents?
You know what it was?
I
cooked up this scheme that if my parents would give me a larger allowance, I would buy my own clothes.
Ah.
So I think at the time most kids were getting about $5 a month for their allowance, and I talked my parents into giving me $20 a month.
Whoa.
And I would buy my own clothes.
Wow. That's impressive. I think I was the $5 a month crowd.
Yep, worked for me.
Wow. So you always had new clothes.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, that's probably what your friend saw and
probably,
said, wow, you must have a tremendous allowance.
Could be. I don't know. I think my parents were just so grateful to be doing better by then that they were happy to share it. And, you know, I kind of feel the same way. I share with my kids, you know, I'm not making them wait until I die for them to get their inheritance. I'm helping them out now. And that's one of the things I want to do.
You said your mom was a stay-at-home mom?
She was a stay-at-home mom until I was about 11 or so, and then she went to work in my father's office. And I remember them coming home from work and sitting around the kitchen table and talking about money and finances and taxes and all of that, which is so, now I find is so rare, you know.
It sure is. It sure is.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so then what did you do with all that information? You said you started being a stockbroker yourself, but prior to that, had you done any investing?
No, I had not. And in fact, my father wanted nothing more than for me to go into business with him, and I just didn't want to do it. It was not appealing to me at all. But, you know, after the marriage, the divorce, and by the way, I was my ex-husband was the exact opposite of my father in terms of, you know, keeping track of money, which he did not do at all. But after I went through that, you know, I not only did I need to support my family, but I really wanted to learn more about money and investing and how to make more of it. And so that was part of what drove me into the, you know, investment business at that time.
Well, did your ex-husband ever share any information with you about mutual funds or finances or any of that?
He was a trader. He was kind of in a different area. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
He was just a standard
stockbroker.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So, do you ever see yourself being retired?
I see my. You know, I love what I do so much that I because I feel like what I do is still so relevant and needed in the world that I can't right now. I definitely cannot see myself retired. I could see myself maybe going into another direction. I'm thinking about, you know, adding on some information on life planning. We're talking about generation planning, which is, you know, certainly uppermost in my mind right now as I, you know, contemplate the last third or quarter of my life, you know, just kind of getting my affairs in order, so to speak. And so I feel like a lot of people are going to need some help with that.
That sounds good. We all appreciate the fact that you're planning on doing that.
Oh, you're not going to let me retire.
No, you have way too many important skills for the rest of us to look good. So we need you to stay around.
Well, thank you.
In your relationship with your daughters, have you taught them much about money yourself?
You know, probably not as much as I should have. A little bit, you know, in terms of you guys should make your IRA contributions. I have one daughter who's a starving teacher. She's a teacher for a private school system. She doesn't make very much money at all. She can barely pay her bills. I did help her buy a house, which is, you know, really was an important thing for her. The other daughter is following in my footsteps. She's a freelance writer, and she's doing quite well, and so I'm talking to her about, you know, the retirement planning and so on. I probably should be doing more in that area, though. I should probably sit them down, you know, and talk about some of these investment instruments that can help them have their money make money. And that is another message that I would like to pass on to women in general is to not be afraid to take risks. You know, one of the best things I've done with my own money is, you know, I bought some pretty good stocks that have done pretty well. And I just see too many women, especially, who are just afraid to dip their toe into the stock market or into any investments that are, you know, that fluctuate in value. And I think they should not be afraid to do that.
Well, then I think you ought to get them both a copy of my book called Power of the Purse.
I will do that.
Which is designed to help women who have no knowledge of this stuff to, you know, dip their toe in and say, oh, look, this is how it works. So a little plug for me. But anyway.
Yes.
Okay. So one other question I wanted to ask you is, who is the most influential woman in your life and what advice did she give you?
You know, I saw that question before this interview, and I have racked my brain, and I cannot think of anyone. I will mention one person, and it was the author of the first financial planning book I ever read, which was around 1980. Her name was Vanita Van Caspel.
Oh,
Do you remember
her? Yes, I read it too, and I loved her.
Yeah, The Power of Money Dynamics, I think it was. Yeah.
Yes.
So that I will say was like my first introduction to the whole world of personal finance. So I would have to name her.
Okay. Well, she was clearly a character, a very flamboyant woman. What I loved about her was the fact that she didn't try to temper who she was by wrapping herself in all kind of masculine clothes and demeanor and everything else. She was who she was, you know.
Right.
She was great. And I think that's part of the appeal was that she didn't give up anything to be who she was.
Yeah.
And I love
it. A woman and proud of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That was really pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're at a point here where I have to wrap this up. Otherwise, we'll go on for hours.
Well, it's been great
fun. Which isn't a bad thing. So I want to say my thanks to my guest, Elaine Floyd, and to all of you in my Power of the Purse community. I hope today's podcast was helpful in enriching your understanding of money and how it can help you achieve your life goals. If you'd like to spend 15 minutes on a call with me and ask me questions about your personal finances, please go to my website, powerofthepursepodcast.com, select the Contact tab, and find a time that works for you. Thanks again, Elaine Floyd, for sharing your time and your knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye for now.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to lynnsevans.com/call and sign up for an exclusive one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.